We'll bring the hearing to order. I want to welcome everyone to this hearing of the Senate Budget Committee. I especially want to welcome our witnesses. I look forward to hearing from them and from you. Today's hearing will focus on the nation's energy crisis. The title of our hearing is Fueling America's Future, Exploring Our Nation's Energy Options. This is an important subject for all of us. I have now been all across the state of North Dakota, and I can tell you this is the number one issue, without question. In every corner of our state, this is what people are talking about, and this is what they want answers to. Our distinguished witnesses today are Larry Scogan, the president of Bismarck State College and the host of our hearing, Lynn Helms, the director of the North Dakota Industrial Commission, the Oil and Gas Division. Good to have you. Our second panel will consist of Randy Schneider, president of the North Dakota Ethanol Producers, and Gene Lattiser, the director of public affairs for AAA of North Dakota. I hope I'm pronouncing Gene's name correctly. Thank you all for being here. I want to emphasize that this is an official hearing of the Senate Budget Committee, and that means we will operate under the rules of the United States Senate, and that means that we allow the witnesses to air their views without fear or favor, without any indication of agreement or disagreement with what they say, and we'll enforce those rules. That is also true of those who would be in the audience. And when the panel is done, we'll open it up to people who are in the audience if they would like to make a statement. And the rule applies to them as well. We want to make certain that people feel that they can express themselves, even if what they say is an unpopular view. We think it is important to hear from all points of view. So we don't want anyone to be discouraged, even if they have an unpopular position. One thing that is very clear is there's not a family in North Dakota that doesn't know what's happening to gas prices and fuel prices and fertilizer prices and all the other components of the energy complex. In January of 2001, gas was still under $1.50 a gallon. We now see gas prices averaging over $4 a gallon. I filled up the other day in Washington, $4.55 I paid. Certainly got my attention. That is not a sustainable trend line. You can see that's a pretty dramatic trend. These gas prices are, of course, driven by the soaring cost of crude oil. As of last Friday, oil prices had risen to over $140 a barrel. The fact is that our nation is dangerously dependent on foreign oil. In 1985, we imported only 27% of what we use. We now import almost 60% of what we use. As a result, we are becoming increasingly dependent on foreign sources. Our dependence is also a driving force behind our trade deficit. $319 billion of our trade deficit last year was due to imported petroleum. Now, that represented nearly half of the total trade deficit. Right now, we are sending over $1 billion a day to foreign countries, many of them unstable, and many of them places we'd just as soon not be sending money. North Dakota is at the forefront of a solution to our nation's energy crisis. We are already one of the leading producers of domestic energy. We rank in the top 10 in the production of petroleum and coal. And it's been reported widely, even in East Coast newspapers like the New York Times, that the Bakken Formation here in North Dakota and in Montana is estimated to hold the largest potential oil resources in the 48 contiguous states. That is an exciting prospect. Once again, North Dakota in a number one position. We also lead in the production of renewable energy alternatives. We're first in the nation in potential wind energy production. We are number one in canola production, which is a feedstock for ethanol. and biodiesel. We are currently ninth in the nation in soybean production, which is also used for biodiesel. In 2006, I introduced my BOLD Act to begin to tackle the growing energy crisis. I saw then that we were headed for a cliff. Many of the provisions from my BOLD Act have been adopted in the recent energy bill, and some of them adopted in the recent farm bill. I'm proud of those advances. The renewable fuel standard that was included in the BOLD Act, including the required use of advanced biofuels such as cellulosic, has been enacted into law. Support for the development of advanced vehicles. Increased funding for bioenergy research and development. Development of lightweight vehicle materials. And development of a smart electric transmission grid for increased reliability and cost savings have all now become the law of the land. All of those were in the original BOLD Act introduced 2 years ago. And I see people around this room who advised me on the BOLD Act. I think we can all take pride in those provisions being adopted. I'm particularly proud of the adoption of my provision promoting the use of advanced biofuels. Under the energy bill, biofuels will climb to 36 billion gallons by 2022. Of that, 21 billion gallons will have to be advanced biofuels like cellulosic ethanol. That is a fuel that North Dakota is well suited to grow and produce. I'm also proud of the significant energy investments included in the congressional budget that I wrote that has now been adopted by Congress in both houses. These investments will create green jobs, reduce our dependence on foreign energy, strengthen our economy, and help with high home energy costs. Specifically, the budget resolution included energy tax incentives, $2.8 billion of funding over the President's proposal for energy initiatives, and energy reserve funds for proposals to reduce our nation's dependence on imported energy. It also is important to note that the Farm Bill we passed last month has a powerful energy title to assist farmers who grow crops for advanced biofuels, and it supports the new refineries that are necessary turn those crops into fuel. But still, we need to do more. I have proposed on this trip home a 5-point plan. It's really a 24-point plan, but it's got five major points. There are 24 elements to it. The five overriding points are first to increase domestic production of oil. I strongly support the development of the Bakken Formation, but we need to do more. I support more areas being opened in the Gulf. And that was part of the BOLD Act, and part of that proposal has been adopted, but more could be done, and I believe more should be done. Those areas that I proposed opening are significant, but we could go further. And I am proposing that we do that. I think we've got to look not only in the Gulf, but offshore as well. I think we also need to do more to encourage new capacity to refine oil into gasoline so we avoid the shortfalls we had in diesel last year. And I support efforts to build another refinery here in North Dakota if that becomes economically viable. Second, I believe we have to rein in speculation. The head of Northwest Airlines came to see me several weeks ago. He told me that their economists believe up to a third of the price of oil is speculation. He pointed me to the evidence that they have of dramatic increase in hedge fund activity in oil markets and talked about the extraordinary leveraging opportunity that exists in oil. For a margin requirement of 5 to 7%, and that margin changes, it's been as high as 9%, as low as 5, you can control a $100,000 contract for oil. In other words, if you put up $7,000, you can control a $100,000 contract. Now you think about that. If oil then goes up 7%, you've doubled your money. But it's more, much more than that, because hedge funds are not just putting up the 7,000; they are borrowing part of the 7,000. So now, if you look at cash on cash, cash on their cash, the leveraging opportunity becomes many times the 14-to-1 multiple that would exist if they put up all the money. You know, if you want to go buy stock in the stock market, you've got to put up at least 50% of the money. The testimony before Congress has indicated that if we would increase the margin requirement from the current roughly 7%, and I use roughly because these things change. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission changes the margin requirements not infrequently. That if we'd increase the margin requirements to perhaps 25%, as is in my proposal, that could do more in the short term to bring down the price of oil than any other thing. But I want to make clear, we got to do much more than deal with speculation. In addition to adjusting margin requirements, there are many other things that we need to do. We need to require the hedge funds to report their positions. CFTC has said in testimony they don't know the positions that have been taken by hedge funds. We also have to deal with this on an international basis, because if we increase margin requirements here, people could simply go offshore and go into the London Exchange, for example. We have already what we call the London loophole, and engage in marketing there with lower margin requirements. So this is going to require a coordinated international response, and my proposal calls for that. Third, we need to further promote fuel efficiency and alternative fuel vehicles. The higher fuel economy standards we passed in the energy bill are a good start, but they're only that. We need to increase our investment in plug-in electric cars and other advanced vehicles to really help us reduce our use of oil. Fourth, we need to increase the production and use of biofuels. This is at least what I believe. The Farm Bill gave us a major step forward there, but we also need to develop the infrastructure to bring those biofuels in larger amounts to the pumps. We've got to have incentives for the infrastructure. You know, even if you've got the fuel, if you don't have the pumps for the fuel, you're not going to accomplish much. And fifth and finally, and this is also controversial, but I believe that it makes sense, I think we have to develop coal to liquid fuels. Our country has a 250-year supply of coal, and we can turn that into liquid fuel in an environmentally responsible manner. And I have applied certain criteria to that goal in order to make it environmentally friendly. I know that some think you should have to be able to sequester with any new products 80% of the emissions. I don't believe that that is realistic at this moment. I think you've got to walk before you can run. And we are calling for a 65% standard. You know, you look at what's happening in North Dakota at the Great Plains plant. We are able to sequester 50%. That's the biggest coal sequestration project in the world going on right here in North Dakota. We can be proud of that. But I don't believe an 80% standard that some have called for is realistic. 65% is a stretch, let's be frank, and maybe that will have to be adjusted based on the testimony that we receive, but it's a good place to start. It is absolutely critical that we have bipartisan support in Congress for these efforts. That's why before I left Washington last week, I organized, along with Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss, a bipartisan effort involving 10 senators to create a group to be committed to devise legislation that could pass. Actually, Senator Chambliss came to me and said, you know, Kent, we were able to work effectively together on the Farm Bill. He said, I got my Republican talking points, He said, I'm sure you've got your Democratic talking points. Both sides are pointing fingers at each other. Not much is going to get done. Maybe what we need to do is come together with a group that says, let's find the things we could agree on. He said, for example, I know your BOLD Act called for expanding production in the Gulf. He said, you know, some of us from southern states were resistant to that because we could see ourselves potentially being adversely affected. He said, I, for one, am ready to revisit that and be more aggressive in opening areas in the Gulf. We talked about other things that might be done. And what we have tried to do is begin to move in a direction of producing a bill that could be passed and could be signed. We're not going to do any good if we do things that aren't actually implemented. So we have tried to identify things that would have broad support. I am delighted that these 10 senators have come together, 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans. My first proposal to them was that we ask our combined leadership to hold a one-day energy summit upon our return. Our leadership has agreed that they will proceed with that effort to bring in people from industry, to bring in people with academic expertise, to bring in people with different viewpoints. Let's just not listen to people who all think the same way or might agree with us. Let's bring in people with different strains of thought and see what kind of proposal we could put together on a joint basis that might actually succeed. As a first step, we wrote the leadership. We have that letter with us for those who might be interested. We believe the solutions developed at the summit will guide us as we write legislation that will have a meaningful impact. We're committed to passing this legislation as soon as possible. I, again, want to thank everybody. That's a lengthier statement than I would normally make at a hearing, but I think it's important to set the stage for what really is on the minds of North Dakotans all across the state. With that, I want to especially welcome our host, Dr. Scogin. Welcome you to witness table, and please proceed.
Thank you, Senator Conrad. I appreciate this opportunity to provide testimony today. Bismarck State College plays an important role in the national energy dialogue about our energy through our energy education programs. Thus, I'm very pleased to provide an overview of those programs. When we see the forecast for employment growth in the energy industry and the increasing demand for workers, it is clear that BSC has positioned itself for responding to those needs. Over the years, we have received estimates from our industry partners that range from 30 to 70% of their workforce expecting to retire in the next 5 to 10 years. This is supported by the United States Department of Labor's 2007 High Growth Job Training Initiative report. In the overview of the energy industry and its sectors, the report states that the average age of workers in the industry is over 50. And the industry estimates that up to half of its current workforce, more than 500,000 workers, will retire within 5 to 10 years. There is also a need to hire new workers for the new power plants and other new technologies. According to the report, if new power generation facilities are built, the industry estimates that it will need 21,000 new workers to build the plants and another 5,000 to operate them. With our programs delivered on campus and online, Bismarck State College has become a leader in training the highly skilled workforce that is required for North Dakota and the nation's energy industry. BSC launched the Power Plant Technology Program on campus in 1976 in response to industry demand at a time when North Dakota was seeing a surge in new power plants but lacked the skilled workforce to get them up and running. Since then, BSC has added several other programs that meet the needs of the energy industry. The programs are diverse enough for the workforce needs of other industries such as manufacturing and telecommunications. Often, the training and education students receive at BSC is transferable to other technologies. For example, graduates of our power plant technology program are employed in the wind farms. Federal recognition of our achievements in energy education occurred in May 2007. Through Senator Dorgan's efforts, BSC was designated by the U.S. Department of Energy as a National Power Plant Operations Technology and Education Center. This designation recognizes BSC for our expertise in training and educating operators and technicians in the energy industry. Since 2002, BSC established two programs with the Energy Providers Coalition for Education. The Electric Power Technology Program focuses on distribution, primary for electric utilities. A Nuclear Power Technology Program was also developed. BSC also offers electrical transmission systems technology, which is designed for system operators and dispatchers. For many years, BSC has offered programs in electrical line worker and welding. In May, the first group of students graduated with degrees in the new mechanical maintenance technology program. This fall, we will roll out a new instrumentation and control technology program. We developed these programs based on industry need and request. In January, BSC started offering a Bachelor of Applied Science degree in energy management. The online BAS degree is designed to educate energy workers to move into supervisory and management positions. BSC has partnered with 40 of the largest energy companies around the United States. Industry representatives serve on advisory committees to develop and plan the curriculum and continue to have a direct influence on curriculum changes. As ethanol and biodiesel plants have become key in enhancing domestic fuel supplies, BSC and industry representatives work together to modify the process plant technology curriculum so graduates would be especially qualified to work in those plants. As well, in our agricultural studies programs, we've incorporated global information systems, GIS, classes. GIS technologies give farmers the tools to be more efficient, and more efficient farming enhances their ability to support renewable fuels such as ethanol. Another example of our close relationship with industry is that the general managers of two of North Dakota's ethanol plants are members of our Process Plant Technology Advisory Committee. It isn't surprising that these two plants, Red Trail Energy and Blue Flint Ethanol, are run primarily by BSC graduates. BSC students have opportunities to learn more about the industry by job shadowing at plants throughout the country while still working toward their certificate or associate in applied science degrees. BSC customizes online programs to help North Dakota and out-of-state utilities grow their own workers locally, using hometown talent for their individual workforce needs. The North Dakota Department of Labor has approved several apprenticeship programs, which are offered face-to-face, by correspondence, or online. Later this month, BSC will occupy a new facility, the National Energy Center of Excellence. This was constructed through collaboration of government funding at all levels and donations from industry and individuals. BSC has roughly 4,000 graduates of energy-related programs working throughout the country. Last year, over 1,000 students from all over the United States were enrolled in our programs. Of that number, 400 were located in North Dakota. Also in 2007, BSC helped train approximately 300 energy workers through customized non-credit courses and apprenticeship programs. As you can see, BSC has a long history of successfully supporting the workforce needs of our energy industry. Thank you, Senator Conrad, for allowing me this time to give this testimony and for allowing us to host you on our campus.
Dr. Scogin, thank you very much for hosting us. You're very gracious to do so. And thank you for the leadership you're providing in our community. I think we'll look back and see that North Dakota becomes one of the major energy hubs for our entire nation. And the programs that you have are going to help lead the way. So you can be very proud of what's been done here.
Thank you very much, Senator. We appreciate your support.
We appreciate very much what you're doing. Next, we'll turn to Mr. Lynn Helms, who is the Director of the Oil and Gas Division of North Dakota Industrial Commission. Mr. Helms is somebody that has, I think, well-respected credibility across our state. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Senator, and I really appreciate the opportunity to highlight one of North Dakota's treasures, which is the huge petroleum resource that we have here in this state. I enjoyed your comments about the price of gasoline being on everyone's mind. I read a very cute story about that that I thought illustrated that this over the weekend. A couple was getting ready to celebrate their anniversary, and they were debating about what they should do on their anniversary. And so the wife said, "Well, why don't we go somewhere expensive?" And the husband said, "Fine." And they got in the car and drove down to the gas station and filled the car. So, the Bakken Formation, of course, is on everyone's mind, and it illustrates North Dakota's potential to help with growing domestic production, as you have laid out. And I want to spend some time talking about the challenges and potential that lies there. Of course, we know the Bakken is a large, unconventional petroleum resource. I think that's an understatement. The USGS, when they released their study in April, said it is the largest continuous resource that they have evaluated in the lower 48, and you highlighted that. Interestingly, the Bakken, people became aware of it in the 1950s, but at that time they didn't even have the technology to assess its possible potential. In the 1970s was the first attempt at that, and they guesstimated maybe 10 billion barrels in the Bakken. More recently, the North Dakota Geological Survey, Department of Mineral Resources, has participated with Price, whose study was unpublished, and some published studies in 2006 that put that generated capacity at about 500 billion barrels. We did an extensive oil sampling program in the 1990s that showed that the Bakken was dysfunctional. And what we mean by that is typically a source rock like this gives up its oil and it migrates somewhere else where we find it and produce it. But the Bakken has not done that. It has kept all the oil that it has generated within and very near the Bakken. But even in the 1990s, we didn't have the technology to produce this oil. As you know, the more recent, starting in 2001 in Montana, the Bakken came back on the scene with new technology, 21st century technology. We've now evaluated the oil in place in North Dakota in the Bakken and arrived at a number of just under 150 billion barrels that's stored in North Dakota within the Bakken. Now that excludes the Montana, Saskatchewan, Manitoba portions of it, which is where the remainder of that as much as 500 billion barrels lies.
Lynn, could I interrupt you? Yeah. Because, you know, I've been seeing these various releases, and I've tried to understand what it means. I'm sure others do as well, because different numbers are used that are vastly different. USGS, as I reviewed their work, they talk about 3 to 4 billion recoverable. Mm-hmm. Can you help us understand the difference between the 500 billion in the Bakken, Canadian side, Montana, North Dakota, that 500 billion, and the 3 to 4 billion that they've talked about being recoverable? Help us understand that difference.
Senator, that's a very good question, and the numbers are confusing. They're all of tremendous magnitude, but they are confusing. So let's start with the 500 billion barrels. That is the amount of oil that the Bakken has generated over the millions of years that it has been in the process of creating oil. Some of that, a very small amount, has escaped into the lodgepole beds overlying the Bakken. That's what we produce around Dickinson. And a new formation that's coming online, the Three Forks that immediately underlies the Bakken, contains some of that oil. But most of that oil, over 90%, has stayed in the Bakken. So that's the size of the tank, 500 billion barrels of oil. We've narrowed that down to how much is in North Dakota, and 150 billion of that lies in western North Dakota that we now have the technology to go after. There's another 18 billion in central North Dakota that we're still working on the technology to try to go and find that, and that lies in kind of a north-south trend through central North Dakota. So bring that down to what's stored in the area we can go after in western North Dakota, 150 billion barrels. Now, the Bakken being an uncontinuous resource, it's very hard to get the oil out. And so we have estimated that we can get about 1.5% of the oil out of the Bakken that's actually stored in there. And therein do you find the number for North Dakota of 2 billion barrels recoverable, and for the Williston Basin as a whole of up to 4 billion barrels that was estimated by the U.S. Geological Survey. So you go from the oil created, 500 billion, to the oil stored in North Dakota, 150 billion, to what, with our best technology today, we can remove and put into a refinery or a gas station somewhere, which is 2 billion for North Dakota and 4.3 for the entire area.
So the 1.5% that is recoverable of the 500 billion, that's based on current technology. And are there any projections about how much better we could do with the development of technology over 10 years or longer?
Well, Senator, those projections are just in the process of being made. And there is a lot of field work underway to try to develop those projections and develop that technology. One of the efforts is a program that the Department of Energy has funded in Grand Forks, the P-Corps, Plains CO2 Reduction Partnership. And there's a project underway with partial funding from them to attempt CO2 sequestration in the Bakken Formation. And we're pretty confident that that's going to increase that recovery, could double that recovery. So we could be going from 2 billion barrels to 4 billion pretty easily. There's also efforts underway that have been funded through the Oil and Gas Research Council, a state program, to develop better fracturing technology, better drilling technology. And several of those are becoming more mature, and it looks like we're learning ways to truly increase the recovery of this resource potential. 1.4% is unbelievably low. A normal oil reservoir, we recover 20%. Ultimately, injecting carbon dioxide and that sort of thing, 50%. So it gives some tremendous incentive to these young people that are going to go to Bismarck State College and work on the new technologies to go after that other 49% that we don't have the ability to recover today. Now, just kind of finishing up, there are some challenges associated with this. People ask, well, how long can this go on? The portion of the Bakken that we have the ability to extract oil from today covers over 8.4 million acres.
Maybe just interrupt it. I think if we move those microphones, they're probably creating feedback.
Okay. The portion that we have the ability to go after today covers over 8.4 million acres, and our current rig fleet is going to take 13 to 26 years to develop that area. So this is going to be a very long, sustained process in developing our petroleum resources in western North Dakota. There's good news and bad news in that. Very good news for North Dakota, because we'll have lots of activity for many, many years. Bad news is we'd like to be able to bring that production on this year and really have a huge impact. But it's going to take us a decade to have the kind of impact we want to have on petroleum production nationwide and on oil and gas prices. So there's good and bad in that. Along with that, to achieve those kind of levels, we're going to have to build more pipelines. We're going to have to build natural gas processing plants. We're going to need electric generation and transmission. We know that to achieve those kind of production levels, we're going to need another 400 megawatts of electricity, and we're going to have to deliver that to the oil and gas fields. And we're going to need refining capacity in order to process that oil. We touched on the workforce needs just a little bit, but just to give you the sense of what's required for the petroleum industry, to pull this off, we're going to need 12,000 new workers. That equates to 8 new people a day in order to achieve what we need to achieve in our petroleum resource in North Dakota. These workers and their families need housing. They need medical facilities. They're going to need schools and recreation facilities. They're going to need all the other services that our modern culture expects and that young people need for us to provide. So tremendous opportunities, tremendous challenges here in North Dakota. Thanks again for the opportunity to talk about those and to put them up in front of Congress, in front of the Senate, and in front of the public.
Thank you. Thanks for your really good work, and it's fascinating, and it's exciting.
I tell you, I have had a number of senators, when the USGS survey came out, who came to me and said, is this true about the Bakken? And this is really happening in North Dakota?
You know, it's really interesting, the reaction of people. One of the things you find representing our state is people generally don't think of us as a major oil and gas producer. We already are. But I don't know, I don't think the media, national media, quite ever caught up with that. So it's one thing that they just don't talk about when they talk about North Dakota. Thank you very much for your testimony. We call to the witness table Randy Schneider, the president of the North Dakota Ethanol Producers Association, and Gene Lattiser, public affairs director for AAA. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes.
Lattiser. Gene Lattiser. Now, Gene and I were together the other day. Good to have you here.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for taking the time to come and testify. Randy, we've worked together many times, and it's always good to see you, and appreciate your being available to testify today.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Senator Conrad. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on behalf of the North Dakota Ethanol Producers Association. In a time when oil is trading at record highs of over $140 per barrel, gasoline prices are averaging over $4 per gallon, natural gas prices have increased 154% since last August, and increasing heating and electrical rates, North Dakota stands in a unique position to provide significant amounts of clean, renewable energy, including ethanol and wind-generated electricity for our nation. Fostering development of the renewable energy industries in North Dakota will help us moderate these price increases, move us toward energy independence, and provide meaningful economic development here in North Dakota. We are already seeing results thanks to congressional efforts to enact and expand the renewable fuel standard. The ethanol industry has grown from producing less than a billion gallons in 1990 to an industry with 160 ethanol biorefineries with 9.25 billion gallons of production capacity today. In addition, 43 new plants are under construction, and 7 more are undergoing expansion, which will add an additional 4.35 billion gallons of annual capacity. Today, ethanol is blended in more than 50% of all U.S. gasoline. It is extending our nation's gasoline supply and helping keep gasoline prices from skyrocketing even higher. In June, Francisco Blanc, a commodity strategist with Merrill Lynch, reaffirmed that ethanol currently is reducing retail gasoline prices consumers pay by 50 cents per gallon. A recent study by Iowa State University found similar results that ethanol was moderating gasoline prices by 29 to 40 cents per gallon. As gasoline prices skyrocketed, this savings is significant. North Dakota consumes approximately 330 million gallons of gasoline a year. A 50 cent savings at the pump means $165 million to North Dakota motorists on a yearly basis. Not only is ethanol saving consumers dollars at the pump, but it is having a significant impact on economics throughout rural America. According to a recent study by LECG, the ethanol industry added $47.6 billion to the nation's gross domestic product, created nearly 240,000 new jobs, and added $12.3 billion to America's consumers' income in 2007 alone. According to Dr. Donis Pedersen of the Nebraska Public District, a 100 million gallon per year ethanol plant on average expands a local economic base by $233 million each year, increases household income by $7.9 million annually, creates approximately 45 direct jobs plus 101 indirect jobs throughout the area, and creates millions more in increased local and state tax revenue. Finally, ethanol is playing a critical role in helping reduce our reliance on foreign sources of fuel. Today, the United States imports 12% or 16.9 billion gallons of the total refined gasoline consumed across the United States. The ethanol industry is on pace to displace 77% of all gasoline imported into the United States each year when all facilities under construction are brought online. I mention all of this as a way to illustrate how far we have come in a very short time, and we can do more. Thanks in part to your leadership in 2006 in calling for an expanded renewable fuel standard in the Breaking Our Long-Term Dependence, or BOLD, Energy Act, the expanded RFS enacted into law last December calls for use of 36 billion gallons of renewable fuels by 2022, with 15 billion gallons from traditional corn ethanol and another 21 billion gallons from new cellulosic sources. The North Dakota Ethanol Producers believes that we can meet and exceed 15 billion gallons of ethanol production from corn while continuing to meet all other uses. USDA predicts that corn yields will increase to 178 bushels per acre by 2015. Monsanto predicts 300 bushel per acre corn yields by 2030. Using USDA's data, we could see sufficient corn production on the same number of acres to produce 21 billion gallons of ethanol by 2015, all while continuing to meet base demand from all uses, other uses of corn. Using Monsanto's projections, we could produce 26 billion bushels of corn on the same number of acres as today in 2030, which is enough to meet demand for all other uses of corn and produce 60 billion gallons of ethanol. These yield numbers show that the federal government should not artificially limit the amount of ethanol that we can generate from corn. Despite recent rhetoric from ethanol opponents, we can expand the corn ethanol industry in the United States while continuing to supply sufficient corn for our food, feed, and export markets in the United States. Additionally, it is critical the federal government continues its strong support of the renewable fuel standard to ensure continued investment and development of the cellulosic ethanol industry. Cellulosic ethanol has great promise, but strides must be made to be able to produce it on a commercial scale at a competitive price. Private investors are leveraging federal assistance and the promise of market demand to make the promise of cellulosic ethanol real. That said, investment dollars in second-generation ethanol will shrink if it looks like the federal government is backing away from its commitment of ensuring a place in the transportation fuel supply for renewable fuels. It is critical that the federal government not waive the RFS schedule because it would send the wrong message to investors and slow the development of the cellulosic ethanol industry. While the ethanol industry will be able to produce enough ethanol to meet the RFS mandate, it is critical that we continue to foster new demand in the transportation fleet. Because of the successful growth of the ethanol industry, it is estimated that we will meet the demand of the current 10% blend market with corn-based ethanol within the next 2 to 3 years. To meet the calls in the current RFS, policymakers must help facilitate the use of higher blends and E85 in order for us to break through the 14 billion gallon blend wall. This will ensure that ethanol from both corn and cellulosic sources can continue to thrive, and we can further decrease our dependence on petroleum. Importantly, we must do more to foster the development of E85 infrastructure in the United States. Today, fewer than 1,500 of the nearly 180,000 retail gasoline stations in the United States offer E85. Congress has taken steps to help. In last year's energy bill, Congress included language prohibiting major oil companies from barring franchise owners from offering non-branded E85. Additionally, the federal government has included tax credits to offset the 30% of the cost of installing E85 pumps, but more is required. One of the most significant issues facing...
Maybe I could just stop you on that point and say in this proposal, you don't see it here, but if you look at the sub-elements of the plan, we propose going to 50% from 30%.
That's fantastic.
Because it is very clear the infrastructure has got to catch up here.
That's exactly right. Again, we see, again, there being four steps in the supply chain of the delivery. Again, from the corn farmer to we as producers to the wholesale distributors into the retail and again, is that we do everything we can to help the front three without doing anything to deal with the fourth, and we will not accomplish our mission. So again, thank you for that. One of the most significant issues facing significant expansion of E85 is blender economics. Currently, flex-fuel vehicles are not designed to take advantage of E85's high octane. As a result, flex-fuel vehicle owners receive fewer miles per gallon running on E85 than on conventional gasoline. This direct impact on consumers requires that E85 be sold at a discount to gasoline for it to be competitive in the marketplace. This has led to fewer gallons of E85 being produced. Fuel retailers must have confidence that E85 will be priced appropriately and that there will be sufficient consumer demand when determining whether to install an E85 pump. To improve E85 economics and spur rapid expansion of E85 pumps, the federal government should create a blender credit for ethanol blended into E85 with the existing VTEC system. This credit would compensate for the discount resulting from the loss in miles per gallon efficiency. And establishing this incentive serves two purposes. First, it will level the playing field for ethanol blended into E10 versus E85 and will lead to additional E85 pump infrastructure. Second, it will ensure that E85 is priced properly at the pump for consumers. This will help make a fuel retailer's decision to offer E85 more straightforward, will provide necessary economic incentives for rapid expansion of E85 pumps across the country. Rural America is already playing a significant role in reducing our nation's dependence on foreign oil by producing fuels from the farms such as ethanol and biodiesel. These efforts are revitalizing rural communities across the country while providing critical savings to America consumers. We must continue to foster the growth and development of this industry, and I look forward to working with you, Senator Conrad, on these important matters.
Thank you, and maybe I could just ask you a couple of questions before we go to Gene. I was just in Minot at a farm and made a presentation not unlike the presentation I made at the beginning of this hearing, and a gentleman was there, asked how long until we get cellulosic, and I told him I don't know the answer to that question. Can you help us understand what are we hearing from the scientific community?
What is, I think, is really important is in the last year, we've really devoted time, energy, and dollars to finding the solution. Senator Conrad, I think the answer is probably, is probably about 5 years away. Now, again, as we can make ethanol from cellulosic sources, the real challenge we have is to make it commercially viable.
Right.
And today, a cellulosic ethanol plant is probably going to be 1.5 times the cost of a traditional ethanol plant. And the economic matrix just doesn't work in that scenario. And so what we're going to have to try to do again is accelerate the throughput or the amount of ethanol that we can produce. And again, that's from enzyme development and a whole lot of other sources. So I would say that again is we're probably about 5 years away from that answer.
I'm so glad you said that, because that was my estimate to him. In the Farm Bill, we call it the Food Energy Conservation Act, we redirected resources. We reduced the per gallon support for corn-based ethanol, and we shifted about $500 million to the research for cellulosic, because everyone has agreed you can only go so far on corn-based ethanol. We really need cellulosic here to take up a big chunk of the load if we're going to get to 36 billion by 2022, 36 billion gallons by 2022. Do you think, from what you know, that investment of $500 million over the 5 years of this farm bill will make a significant difference with respect to the development of cellulosic? What is the scale of the investment required? Do we have an idea?
Well, I think, again, certainly the dollars that have been allocated to cellulosic ethanol is making a difference. There's no doubt about that. I'm very, again, I can confidently state that. And I think the important part of it is a lot of where some of the dollars are being allocated toward is actually kind of migrating from the laboratory actually into pilot plants. And we are going to learn a lot by actually having something pretty close to what would be a scalable operation that would you'd literally build a plant to that size. So I think those dollars were wisely spent and allocated, and I think we're going to again learn a lot, as I said, because again, as we have literally we're building some of these pilot plants.
You made mention in your testimony of how much of our current fuel is coming from ethanol. What was that number?
The on average, as we're currently producing about is probably in that 10 billion gallon range is where we'll probably be at the end of 2008.
10 billion at the end of 2008. So we've made enormous strides.
Absolutely, yes, we have.
I mean, it's very dramatic how far we've come.
Final question, if I could. This is controversial, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we now have people pressing back saying, look, you have already directed too much of our corn resource to ethanol, and that is raising food prices in the grocery store. It's raising feed prices for our cattlemen. What would your response be to those concerns?
I believe that the role of ethanol does have or does play a role in increased food prices. However, on a list of 100 reasons why food prices have gone up, I would suspect that ethanol is about number 98 on that list. Again, as I was glad to hear what you're talking about from dealing with some of the speculative nature, directed toward oil. But again, I think you can, that change in the law that you're contemplating goes well beyond oil. Again, I think it's going to be with all commodities. And I think we could see a significant decrease in the price of corn if we started passing some of the legislation that you're contemplating. I think the other thing, again, is remember in a $3.50 box of corn flakes, there's only about 7 cents of corn. And, transportation plays an important role in the production and the processing and the movement of food in this country. And so, I think there are a whole host of other reasons why food is priced where it is at. And I will admit there is a part of ethanol that has possibly increased the price of food, but on that list we're close to the bottom.
Now I get asked this as we're going through the food and energy bill debate. I was asked repeatedly by national media about these issues, and I reminded them. First of all, supply and demand, same thing in oil. I mean, let's not forget that is the predominant force that is affecting these prices, supply and demand. You know, we just have to look around the world. You can see China and India are industrializing. That is dramatically increasing the demand for energy, dramatically increasing the demand for all food commodities. You know, when people become more prosperous, the first thing they do is they eat better. The second thing they do is consume more energy. Second factor in all of these commodities is the weakness of the dollar. The dollar has gone down more than 40% against the euro, and oil and the agriculture commodities are sold in dollar terms. So when the dollar goes down in value, that puts enormous upward pressure on the price those commodities in dollars. Third factor is the speculative factor, and the truth is, I believe nobody knows for sure how big a contributor speculation is in oil or in the agriculture commodities. But we've certainly heard enough testimony from enough credible people to believe it could be significant, and therefore it seems to me we ought to try some things.
not just sit here, but try some things. And we don't want to go overboard. We recognize that there is a value to people investing in these areas, even if they're not intending to take delivery. And of course, one of the things we know about hedge funds in the oil markets is they aren't taking, by and large, they're not going to take delivery. So that tells me we ought to do some experimentation.
If I may, Senator, yeah, just is again is and you're absolutely correct with that those statements. The other thing I think again is the size and the scope of the problem and the need to deal with this is in my opinion is very urgent. If you take a look at India and China, again, as they have, as you indicated, a growing middle class, and their caloric intake is going to increase dramatically from protein sources. And so, again, as their demand for food is going to increase. I've heard statistically right now there are about 300 million, what we would define as maybe middle class Chinese, and that is going to grow to about 600 million in the next 10 years. Statistically, on average, in the United States, we have about 800 cars per 1,000. China has 12 cars per 1,000. India has about 7 cars per 1,000. Begin to imagine the scope and size of the problem when those 600 Chinese decide that they not only want a car, a TV, a car, a motorbike, you know, boat or whatever. I mean, begin to imagine the demand on fuel that needs to be produced in this world to deal with that growing middle class in both China and in India.
You know, we've got a reality to deal with. The world is changing. It's changing rapidly. The statistic that you just used was just shared with us in the hearings last week in Washington. In China, 12 cars per 1,000. Here, 800 cars per 1,000. And you know, the number of Chinese that are going to be able to afford cars is growing dramatically. So as they come closer to approaching our usage, you can imagine what that's going to do to demand for oil and all other energy products. You can imagine what it's going to do for food products. So this is a, you know, this is right at the heart of this is the supply-demand relationship. That's reality. And we've got to work on that relationship. I think that's got to be our number one focus. Now, those things you can't change real quickly. You know, you can't increase production overnight. You can't have reductions, conservation measures adopted overnight. Probably the thing that can have the most effect in the short term, according to, I'd say, most of the testimony we've received, is to deal on the speculative side of the house. But that's pretty a short-term exercise. If we don't deal with the supply-demand relationship over time, expand supply, reduce demand, we're going to have a runaway train on our hands.
Exactly right.
Gene, thank you for being patient, and special thanks for being here. Please
go. Senator Conrad, and then for the opportunity to share with you how skyrocketing energy prices are having an effect on North Dakota's motorists. In 2004, when I first joined AAA as an spokesperson on gasoline prices, the price of gas was already an important issue. Just 2 months into the job, I was barraged with calls from our members and the news media wanting to know why gas prices had pushed past the high water mark then of $2 per gallon. They wondered why gas prices were spiking, how long it would last, and when the increases would end. A little more than 3 years later, we're still hearing the same questions, now with regular gasoline having doubled in price and the price of diesel fuel having shot up by more than 160%. It must be clear that North Dakota relies on fuel. The two leading industries in our state, agriculture and tourism, are greatly impacted by the cost of gas and diesel. Current high fuel prices have increased the costs associated with farm work and threatened tourism by increasing the cost of travel. The bottom line is that many North Dakotans rely on motor vehicles, their own and others, for their livelihood. Like all Americans, North Dakotans cherish and rely on personal mobility, and we're self-reliant, with vehicle ownership that ranks fifth highest in the nation. And more than half of those vehicles are trucks, much higher than the national average truck ownership of 38%. Our trucks use more gasoline than passenger cars, and thus North Dakotans are being hit extremely hard at the pump. The effects of high gas prices on North Dakotans is compelling. In 2004, North Dakota motorists spent an estimated $686 million on gasoline during the year, based on an average cost of $1.85. Last year, we spent an estimated $1 billion on gasoline for the year, based on an average cost of $2.87. And this year, the annual fuel bill could exceed $1.3 billion. The North Dakotans are traveling less. In the first 4 months of this year, total vehicle miles traveled in North Dakota has dropped an estimated 2%. And for the first time this decade, AAA is projecting a decrease in holiday travelers over the 4th of July holiday. Travel is expected to be down at least 1.3% this upcoming weekend compared to last year.
Can I stop you on that point?
When I talk to the people, especially out in the western part of the state, at the tourist attractions there, they are talking to me about much steeper reductions than the overall 1%. Do you have any breakdown of the distribution? Do you see a larger reduction in the western part of the state?
Our statistics don't take North Dakota itself into consideration. I mean, North Dakota is pooled in with the rest of the states, and we're considered part of the Midwest as far as our reporting is concerned. But as far as the Midwest is concerned, it looks like the decline in travel will be even more
than
1.3%. We're looking at closer to 2%. And to your point, and talking to other people myself about their travel plans for the 4th of July holiday, it would seem like a number greater than 2 out of every 100 that would be staying home. It seems to be greater. I think these numbers are actually optimistic, as this study was done a couple months ago when gas prices were probably 50 cents cheaper. And at that time, they indicated the higher the gas prices would go, the more that would likely stay closer to home. So I think you're right that probably these numbers are actually optimistic.
Yeah. Well, I sure am hearing that from the tourist people in western North Dakota.
Yeah. Well, that's unfortunate, because we're actually probably fortunate here in North Dakota in that we can still draw from Canadian tourism because of the positive exchange rate. Plus, North Dakota is one of the least expensive, or is the least expensive state in which to vacation. So we're hoping that people looking to stretch their vacation dollar are actually looking at North Dakota to come. So it's disheartening to hear that in at least the western part of the state, they're seeing their greater reduction.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
And in a survey last fall, when gasoline was $1 cheaper than it is now, 70% of AAA members in North Dakota indicated they had taken steps to conserve fuel due to higher gasoline costs. In that same survey, our North Dakota members said lawmakers should take the following measures to decrease the country's dependency on foreign oil: require better fuel efficiency for new cars, trucks, and SUVs; allow more drilling and oil exploration in North America; increase funding for research on alternative fuels; increase public transportation options; and establish national conservation programs. The reality is that cost of gasoline is forcing some North Dakotans to struggle to make ends meet. The personal tales are more compelling than the data. I have heard countless stories from fellow North Dakotans on fixed incomes who are skipping doctor's appointments and other important daily activities because of the high gasoline prices. A couple weeks ago, a handwritten note from one of our members pleaded, "Please help us get gas prices back to normal," after explaining how his family was being impacted. And AAA North Dakota has even seen an increase in roadside assistance calls from motorists who have run out of gas while hoping gas prices would fall even a few cents. In closing, AAA believes that officials at all levels of government should recognize the tremendous impact high gasoline prices have on motorists. AAA urges the federal government to adopt a national policy which combines increased fuel production, the efficient use of traditional and alternative fuels, and the elimination of roadblocks to the development of new sources of energy. I am confident that with the committed leadership in both the public and private sector, and with the support of the public, we can achieve a sensible energy policy. I'm happy to see that your five-point plan addresses virtually all these concerns of our members and our national stance on the energy issues, and I look forward to any questions you might have.
Well, I thank you for that, and I noticed in terms of what you'd outlined that we do very closely match. I think the only place that you made a reference that I don't have in this plan is public transportation. And certainly that's got to be part of this as well. I think another thing is rail. Rail is incredibly efficient on a fuel per ton basis. And we are rapidly approaching a place where we are at the limits of what much of the rail system in the country can handle. They are very close to being at capacity. And so that means we got to expand capacity on the rail system as well. We have 10 minutes left before we've committed to go to the next event. So I wonder if we could open it to the audience that's here. If anybody would like to testify for the record, feel free. If you just come to the front of the room and identify yourself for the record so the recorder can get your name. We certainly want to give people who are here a chance to testify. If anybody would like to add something for the record, we will keep the record open for 3 days. So that if you wanted to submit, if you're not comfortable speaking here, if you'd like to submit something for the record in writing, we will hold the record open for 3 days. But anybody who is in the audience who would like to make a statement, please feel free. Welcome.
Do you have a microphone?
If you just come to the front of the room, because our recorder is right here.
No problem.
Welcome. Good to see
Senator,
you.
Good to see you again, too. With regard to...
If you just...
With regard to coal to liquids specifically, some of us who are in that industry now are working with newer technologies that would be lower in capital cost and inherently better carbon capture, more efficient processes, and a lot of the processes that have been used traditionally are quite old, 60 or 70 years old. Doesn't mean they don't work. They could use some improvement, we think. Is there going to be an effort to be technology agnostic when it comes to legislation that would promote coal to liquids so that the technology marketplace could remain competitive?
You know, yet to be seen, I think, honestly. What I have proposed here is met with, and coal to liquids, of all of the elements of my proposal that have been the most controversial, it wasn't opening the Gulf. I thought that might be the most controversial. The most controversial is coal to liquids. But I think realistically it's got to be part of an overall package. Now, you know, it's also right to insist on certain standards, which we're doing here. But they've got to be achievable standards. They can't be pie-in-the-sky stuff from people who just want to kill it. And there are those who just want to kill it. So how that battle is going to come out, I'm not certain. But in this proposal, we have been pretty aggressive. We put $500 million into research. We've put up to $10 billion of loan guarantees on the table for coal to liquids, and I honestly don't know how it's going to come out. I can tell you, of all of the elements that are in this proposal, 24 different elements, those have been the most controversial.
Doubt about that. Would there be support, do you think, for looking at newer, hopefully better ways, more efficient ways,
less polluting ways. Absolutely, that has to be done.
And thus, could we expect that the technology elements wouldn't be predefined in the legislation? In other words,
certainly not predefined in mine. I think it's a very unwise thing to do to decide what the result is before you have a competition. I mean, to me, that is just an unwise way to proceed. But there are others who have a different view. We have had some very intense conversations with people. There are people who are very hostile to coal in any form. And look, 50% of the electricity in the country comes from coal. This idea that they're going to eliminate the use of coal is not realistic. And we've got to find ways to use it more cleanly. And we got to put money into that. I also believe that we got to find more oil and gas in America. And all these things have a controversy attached to them, as we've seen.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeremy Doctor, the Kinetic Group.
Thank you.
Anyone else who has a question or wants to make a statement? We've just got a few minutes left here.
My name is Jim Huckabulls, and I'm wondering, as one of those 24 points that you're talking about under fuel efficiency, are there things that you're going to promote the simple matter of slowing down, for instance?
Ah, boy, at every stop we've been asked that. At the last stop, a gentleman asked that, and we took a vote. And there were, 40 or 50 people there. What was it, Chris? 40 people there. There were two in favor. Two in favor of slowing down. Let me just say this to you. Joe McGarvey, who is my energy staffer, and a very accomplished, when we looked at putting together our proposal, we did not push reducing the speed limits. And we did not because the experts in the field have told us that the new cars are so much more efficient than what they were even 10 years ago, that the savings that you did get, and there were substantial savings the last time we slowed down in order to conserve, that you get a dramatically reduced savings now with these cars, so that it is much less attractive as an option. Now, that's not to say you don't get savings, because you do. But the savings, am I being correct in what we've been told? Why don't you amplify on the point?
Why don't you stand up, Joe?
This is Joe McGarvey of my staff.
As the senator said, speaking of the Department of Energy, in the 1970s, when we reduced the national speed limit down to 55 miles an hour, there we achieved pretty significant reductions. But today's vehicles, the way they're engineered, they're essentially designed to run very efficiently at higher speeds. So by dropping the speed limit down from 70 to 60, as the senator said, well, there would be a small reduction. It would not be the type of reduction that we might remember from the 1970s when we reduced down to 55 miles an hour.
That was very welcome news to the crowd in Minot. Any other? We're just about at the end here of our time. Anybody else? Randy, any final thought? Anything you'd want to share?
Just simply say thank you for taking the time, because I know you're very busy to come home and listen. It is what you're going to be doing in Washington, D.C. is absolutely, I believe, critical to what we as a country are going to look like as we migrate through and exit the 21st century. I just think it is that critically important.
I do, too. This is a real turning point. Gene, any final thought?
Well, to this gentleman's point about the speed limits, those of us in AAA don't necessarily endorse lowering the speed limits, but we do endorse following the speed limits. And, for safety reasons as well as fuel economy reasons, but I have noticed on the last several trips over here to Bismarck that traffic has slowed down voluntarily considerably.
We have just driven around the whole state. We started in Fargo the other day. We're up to Grand Forks. We're up to Northwood, Rugby, Minot down here. Traffic is noticeably slowed. All right. Thank you all. We appreciate very much the witnesses and all of you for attending.